Today's program has been brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit internationalculinarycenter.com. You're listening to heritageradionetwork.org, a nonprofit, member-supported radio station. We're millions strong, with folks tuning in from over 200 countries. We are education. We are entertainment. We are the future of food. May is our membership drive. Become a member and support us while receiving e-newsletters, advanced invites, special discounts, and a membership card. We need your support. Visit our website and click the donate button to become a member today. Thank you for believing in us and enjoy the show.
Hey, welcome to After the Jump. I'm your host, Grace Bonney, and today we're coming to you live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Before we get started, I wanted to remind everyone listening that May is our sponsorship drive month at Heritage Radio Network. We are a nonprofit, member-supported network, and your donations allow us to keep providing over 3 free and original programs each week. So if you have a second, please check out heritageradionetwork.org and see how you can help and check out our membership packages. Today, my guest is artist, illustrator, and my pencil factory neighbor, Chris Silas Neal. Chris is something of a legend among my artist friends, and his work has appeared on everything from book covers and magazines to newspapers, advertisements, packaging, animations, and gallery shows across the country. It is a real pleasure to have him here today. So welcome, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. I like to say we're sitting very apart, far apart from each other at this table. Typically, I make people sit next to me, but I feel like I have an ocean between us. So I need to project my questions further. I want to start in the beginning, and it's weird because even though you and I have what feels like a million friends in common, I don't actually know that much about your background. And I read a little bit, but I've realized that most people seem to ask you the same question about your background. So I want to know where you grew up and what your family was like.
Yeah. So it's sort of a complex answer to that. And I guess I can start at the beginning. I was born in San Antonio, Texas, and I didn't live there long. And it was just me and my mom. She's a really young, single mother. And we moved around the South for maybe 4 or 5 years. So I've lived in Georgia and Mississippi and New Orleans, born in Texas, and eventually landed in South Florida.
Oh. You seem like the least Southern person to me. Did you leave the South at some point, or was that your whole childhood in the South at somewhere?
I left South Florida when I was 13 and moved to Colorado.
Ah, okay.
So those are more of my formative years in Colorado. And I went to college out there, and I consider myself being, you know, raised in Colorado.
And you don't have any siblings. You're a fellow only childer.
Yeah. Oh, you're an
I'm
only
an only child,
child
too. Oh, yeah. How did that sort of shape your early years? Do you remember what you wanted to be growing up, or were you influenced at all by your mom and your mom's ideas?
Yeah, I was influenced by my mom, and I also think being an only child plays a big role in, you know, how I work now and how I see things. Basically, because I was bored all the time, and
that's a familiar feeling to me growing
up. Yeah, and I think being bored as a kid is good. I think it's something I'm worried about with kids now.
Yeah.
And I always think when I have a kid, I want to make sure that he or she gets bored at times, and they have to come up with interesting ways to entertain themselves.
What was your favorite way to entertain yourself when you were little?
Well, aside from playing with toys and all that stuff, I would, of course, I would draw all the time. I would play music. I had a keyboard, I had drums, I had all kinds of...
Is it a Casio? The ones you could pre-program and like play salsa and mambo and all that?
It was a hot pink Casio. And it just had one octave, and it was really... The keys were really tiny, so they were for like baby hands.
Yeah.
And it had some pre-recorded beats in there, a salsa and a rumba.
Yeah.
And I forget what else. So I'd play music. And I would watch movies all the time, and then I would make up my own movies.
Oh, that's really cool. It's funny because you've done one short film before, or you've done two on your own?
I've done a couple,
right?
Yeah. And, you know, they were just, you know, little 1-minute animation spots.
Yeah.
But doing those was great because it was like being a kid and pretending like I was a movie director. It was a lot of fun.
It's funny. I find that's a really common thread that, at least for all of the only children that I've talked to, is that people sort of find themselves drawn a lot to like writing and music and artwork because that's something you don't necessarily need other children to do.
Yeah.
And I had like a typewriter, and that was my favorite thing in the world because I could like type pretend newspapers and magazines and didn't need other people to help me with them.
Yeah, no, it's true. I also wasn't necessarily athletically gifted either, so that kind of helped.
Yeah.
That kind of helped. And, you know, it's funny about the movies I would make up, I wasn't really interested in plot or anything like that. It was more the special effects.
Oh.
And so I even had a little makeup kit. And so when I would write a movie as a kid, it was a series of explosions and decapitations and gunfights and, you know, wounds that would happen or monsters that would be, you know, I would create all that stuff. I would create the monsters and the special effects and the action, but there would be no plot. I mean,
Do that by yourself, or did you have like neighborhood kids who would volunteer to be the wounded?
Well, sometimes I would do it by myself. And then I had a couple of other friends who are also artistic, and we set about to make a movie at one point. I think it was a Vietnam vet who, after coming back, is disgruntled and then somehow turns into a zombie too. So it was like a zombie Vietnam vet.
Yeah.
Influenced, I guess, by Dawn of the Dead and Full Metal Jacket. And so, but again, we had this whole series of special effects and fight scenes and brain-eating scenes planned out.
That's so good.
But we didn't have any plot other than that.
I'm a zombie obsessor. Yeah. Have you seen that movie about like an undead former Nazi army that's found in Sweden? And it's very similar to your plot line.
No, but
wonderfully exciting. It's so cheesy. And it's like a whole army of undead Nazi soldiers that live somewhere in Sweden, and they're like buried in ice, and these young kids find them on a vacation.
That's funny.
It's really entertaining. I can't think of the name now, but if anybody likes zombies, they should totally listen to it or watch it. You were into music as well as art, but did you think you would sort of focus on either of those when you were little, or did you kind of love them both equally?
Well, I think actually music is what I thought I would be doing, and I actually went to college for music.
How did you choose where you were going to go to school?
Well, it was an accident in a way. So I knew I was going to go somewhere in state, which is Colorado, for tuition purposes, because I couldn't afford to go out of state. And Colorado has a few good music schools. One of them is Greeley, Colorado. And I did my audition there and just completely bombed it. I was really nervous.
Oh, no.
And I just bombed it. And
what did you audition on? Or were it several instruments?
Well, so I play drums. And when you do a percussion audition, you have to play the whole range of percussion instruments. And so I prepared a sort of a rudiment snare drum solo, and I did some stuff on the drum set, and I played the marimba, and I did this classical piece on the marimba, and I think something else too. They have a series of tests they do. You have to sight read something, and I know they have like a series of tests, including sight reading and stuff that you do. And I just bombed it.
Oh, no.
So then I also did an audition with Colorado State University, and they didn't call back either. And I thought it was good, but I don't know. So eventually I auditioned at Colorado University, which is actually the biggest and most... It's the biggest of the three schools and is known for other things. They have a great music program, but they also have a huge astrophysics program. And it's just a really big state school. It's, I think, maybe 30,000 students. And they accepted me, and I got in. And about a year into school, I realized that I didn't want to be a music major. I just wanted to play in a rock band. So I was already thinking about my exit or what I was going to do after, and
exit into rock band or exit out of just music.
Yeah. Exit into rock band out of studying it formally in college. And right about that time, I got a letter from Colorado State University saying, whatever happened to you, you know, we offered you this full ride. We were really looking forward to having you come to the school.
Yeah.
And you just never got in touch, and I had never gotten their letter. And
that's crazy.
Yeah. And at that point, I was like, well, CU is, I guess, a much better school, I think, than Colorado State in terms of wanting to do things other than music.
Yeah.
And I already had friends there, and I loved Boulder, the city where I was living. And so I was like, screw it. I'm just going to continue to, you know, stay here and not take the full ride.
Do you end up majoring in fine art?
No. So I ended up majoring, it's a journalism major.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And the emphasis was on advertising.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And I took one graphic design class that they had there, which they don't have a design school at Colorado University. And the teacher of that class gave me a job as a graphic designer. And
that's
kind of how I got into art.
So is that your first job after school?
Yeah, I actually skipped graduation and went right to work.
Well, so what was that like? What was that first job like?
It was amazing.
Yeah. What did you have to do?
What did I have to do? Well, the list of what I had to do probably doesn't sound amazing, but it was amazing for me to get this opportunity with no experience. But I would design websites and book covers and cookbooks and, you know, a lot of the stuff that I do now, but not from an illustrator's point of view, just setting type and things like that.
Do you remember seeing like the first book cover that you worked on at an actual store? Or did you never see any of those come to fruition?
Well, actually the cookbooks that the books that I was doing covers for, at that time were about fly fishing.
Oh.
Yeah. And so, my boss, he's a big fly fisher and he had a big fly fishing, client, and fly fishing is huge in Colorado. Yeah. So I did see him in the stores, but it wasn't like a mass market thing. It wasn't, you know, it's a little different in that respect. I realized when I was there, even though I didn't know that I wanted to be an illustrator or even what illustration was, that the things that I excelled at the most were coming up with images and little doodles and things that graphic designers do all the time, even though they're not painting or making these elaborate images. A lot of times designers will still have to come up with an image somehow. And that's what I was most successful at when I was working with him.
So how did you transition from there to New York?
So I worked at this place, Studio Signorella in Colorado. Mm-hmm. I worked there for 3 years and I moved to New York just to experience the city, just because I wanted to get out of Boulder.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was very much, you know, I just wanted to live in the big city and see what would happen and maybe work at a big famous design firm.
Where was your first apartment?
And my first apartment was in Williamsburg.
Oh, wow. You started right off at like hipster ground zero.
Yeah, I went right in. My rent was $450 a month.
Wait, when was this?
This was 2002.
Okay.
And it was a pretty crappy apartment. But my
room. How did you find that? I moved to Greenpoint in 2003. My apartment, it was $1,100. And I thought that was like a steal.
Well, so I had two roommates. And my room literally was 6 by 12 inches. So there was, in one direction, I could extend my arms touch either wall.
Yeah.
So it was a shoebox that I was living in.
Yeah.
And we didn't have a living room. We had a sizable kitchen that we kept a couch in and a TV in, plus people would cook. And so we had a kitchen and three bedrooms and one bathroom between us. And so that's what you get for a $450.
Yeah. So what sort of work were you doing when you got there?
When I moved to New York, I got a job at a small design firm. And doing the same things I was doing in Colorado. And it was fun. And the people that I worked with were nice, but I wasn't satisfied. And I realized that I wanted to work for myself.
Yeah.
And I wanted to do something more personal and more, you know, more creatively fulfilling.
Well, I want to ask more about what that transition was like. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back with Chris Silas Neal.
The International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
Hey, welcome back to After the Jump. I'm your host, Grace Bonney, and today I'm speaking with artist and designer Chris Silas Neal. Before the break, we were talking about your transition from Colorado to New York, and I'm always fascinated to hear about people's moves from working for any sort of like other studio or larger company to going out on their own. What was the scariest thing about deciding to go freelance or run your own company, or was that not scary at all for you?
It really, at the time, it wasn't scary. Thinking back on it now, not having any experience as an illustrator, having no, you know, job prospects, no one knowing who I am, not even having a real portfolio together, I probably and the work that I did have wasn't really that great.
Yeah,
I probably should have been a little more worried than I was. But I was in my mid-20s. This is what I wanted.
Yeah,
I believed that I could do it. And so I wasn't really worried. It never really occurred to me that it wasn't going to work out. It was just when and how.
Was your style any different then than it is now? I'm always really fascinated to see if people kind of come out of school with a style that's really similar to what they have now, or if it's evolving. Do you think your style is similar, or do you feel like you've kind of settled on something that you've just been working on the whole time?
The way I work has changed a lot, actually. There are a few nuggets that have stayed the whole time, and it's just sort of intrinsic to the way I work, and especially since I'm self-taught as an illustrator.
Yeah.
There's just certain things, the way I approach things, that have been a thread. But I've gotten better. That's one thing. I've gotten better. I've just, my drawing, the way I draw figures, you know, the ideas that I come up with, a lot of that has changed. So in some regards, if you saw a piece that I did 10 years ago and a piece that I did now, they might look completely different, but mm-hmm. then there's also some things that are exactly the same, like, oh yeah, but he was already thinking this way and
yeah.
he was already doing this.
Do you think that being self-taught has been an advantage? Are there ways you can look at your work and see that it's been set apart because of that? Because I find that, like, especially people who come from very specific art schools often have a very similar style or sort of way of producing things. And I'm always fascinated to see how people who kind of taught themselves how to do this, how their work looks different.
Yeah. Well, I think one advantage is when an illustrator is first starting out, most likely what they do is sort of replicate their heroes and the work that they're interested in. And I was no different, except for I didn't have the techniques to really replicate a lot of this other work. So when I would do it, it would come out completely different, no matter how tried, you know, how much I tried. Like, I would have loved to just replicate and just be, you know, just like so-and-so.
Yeah.
And I would have just been happy that someone would even say, wow, you do it just as good as the other person. And I just couldn't. And because of that, that's how I developed my style, is sort of all of the limitations that I work through. It just created this whole new way of working, I guess.
And do you work primarily by hand, or are you working with like a tablet, or how do you primarily create your work these days?
It's both. I mean, the quick answer is I draw and paint pieces almost like a print, where everything's on a separate layer, and I scan all those pieces and I put them back together in Photoshop. And that's pretty much it. Yeah.
I feel like that's kind of what everybody's method is these days. That's interesting, because it's been an interesting
some form of that anyway.
Yeah, evolution of people kind of combining things to make it work for their particular style. I was reading interviews before this, and I loved that Grain Edit, which is one of my favorite blogs, called your work a lovely break from the chaotic mess that is the internet. And it, to me, if you're listening and you're not familiar with Chris's work, there is sort of this like almost like retro but wonderful like simpleness to some of the things that you do, and there's a flatness that I find so refreshing to like the obsessive amount of like kind of crazy pattern and color that can be in a lot of the sort of print work that you see like on Etsy or, mm-hmm. or makers like that. And I love that your things feel so, so clean. And I think that's often why they work so well for book covers and pieces like that. What was the project or piece that you did that kind of let you know that you had like arrived or you'd made it?
Well, I don't know if there was a particular piece, but when I started working for The New Yorker, that was a big deal.
That's like the holy grail for illustrators, right? That always seems to me like the thing everybody cites is they want to do something for The New Yorker.
Well, and the great thing about The New Yorker is it's broken up into all these sections, of course, if you read the magazine. And the front of the magazine is oftentimes the art is commissioned, or the art that they commission is made by younger illustrators who are just starting out. And so you get to be in one of the most prestigious publications in New York and just starting out with your career. So that's really great. You're unlikely to get a cover when you're just starting out. And some of the back matter, usually they hire more experienced artists. But doing the front of that book, and I still do stuff for the front of that book today. That was really great. And most art directors at some point will pick up an issue of The New Yorker, and I think that really helps get my name around. And also The New York Times as well. So between those two, most of the art directors in New York, I think, got to see my work.
Yeah.
And that's a really great form of promotion.
And you have for people, I've talked about this on the show so many times, but I'm in the Pencil Factory and you're in the Pencil Factory and you're part of this incredibly tight-knit group of illustrators. And how do you think that's kind of affected the way that your work has progressed over the years? I feel like you guys all work for very similar places, but have been able to maintain very different styles. Are you influenced by other people? Are you like spurred on by their success? How does that relationship work?
It's been incredible, and I've definitely 20 gazillion times better because of the people that I sit next to. Because we do constantly look at each other's work, and we're constantly saying, oh, check out this artist, or why don't you try this, or I really like this thing that you did, and then you're encouraged to try it more. And, you know, also, you know, I sit next to an artist named John Hahn, and he's incredible and does this amazing creative stuff. And our work, we work similar, but our work looks completely different, mm-hmm. and that's really cool because we can talk about how we work at the same time. The end result is completely different. I've shared a studio with Sam the longest, Sam Weber, and he's an amazing painter. I mean, he's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And so to see him do what he does and then to look at what I do and for that to be considered the same profession is kind of sometimes ridiculous, but that's why I like illustration. It's like the Wild West. You can do whatever you want. There's no rules. There's no certification. You just go out there and do it, and people will just give you money to do it.
You're making that sound really, really easy. It's just kind of leading into my next question. I feel like everyone I know who's younger, who writes in to blogs or other publications, are asking what advice do kind of seasoned illustrators like you have for people who are trying to get started, which you just made sound very, very easy, but it can't possibly be that easy. What are sort of the main things that you think younger illustrators need to keep in mind when they're just getting started, no matter where they live?
Well, patience does help because it is easy in that the steps are pretty clear. I mean, who needs to see your work? It's just art directors.
Yeah.
You know, designers. And that's an easy client to get a hold of because they like the same stuff you like. It's a lot easier to get a hold of a graphic designer than it is a owner of a restaurant or a owner of a bank, which is sometimes what graphic designers have to do.
Mm-hmm.
So you just have to be patient. Know who you're going after, which are these art directors and designers and editors in some cases. And do what you love and just put it out there. And I think either your work is going to work for magazines and books and all these things that you want to do or it isn't. But I think if you stick with it, like I said, there other than that, there are no rules. So you don't need a college degree. You don't even need a high school diploma. I know it sounds weird, but no one checks or asks. I mean, you have to be intelligent and be able to interpret a piece of text. But
yeah.
You don't really need anything other than a good, solid piece of work, you know, a good portfolio.
How important do you think it is these days for illustrators of any age or experience type to have a presence outside of their actual body of work, like social media, primarily like Instagram or online sketchbook blogs, things like that? For my medium, it seems very much like that's a necessity to get your work out there. Do you feel like that's the case, or do you feel like illustrators, like getting your work out there is enough?
Well, we talk about this all the time and how much that really matters and whether some people are actually just professional Twitter people and they're not actually illustrators or what's going on. And I think that you would be a fool to not do all of it. And hopefully you can do it and have fun with it, because it will be, it will definitely come off as and genuine if you're doing it just because you think you have to. So it has to be, you know, coming from an honest place. But yeah, you would be a fool not to do it all, because, you know, you never know who and where is looking and reading what.
Yeah.
And as an illustrator, you're just, you want as many people as possible to see your work. So yeah, so do everything, do it all.
I want to ask a completely different, unrelated question. As somebody who walks past your office many times a day and looks inside, you recently seem like you've made the switch from a sitting to a standing desk.
Yes.
I want to know what that change is about. I've been thinking about it, and I watched this video online about this girl who put a treadmill next to her standing desk, and just actually, I'm doing a dog paw motion, I don't know why, but if you're walking on that treadmill, and I've thought about it, because most bloggers I know are the most sedentary people on earth, what inspired you to make that change to standing all day?
Well, my back was hurting from sitting all day.
Yeah.
And reading all these articles about how bad sitting all day is for you, I thought I would give it a try. And my friend Alex, who you've had on the show before, he has a standing desk. And I asked him, well, what is it like? Do you like it? And he said, it's great. And literally the next day, I went out and got some buckets and put my cheap IKEA desk on these paint buckets.
Yeah.
And I'm still testing out the exact height that I want, and then I'm going to have a real table built. But it's been great.
I think that's fascinating. Yeah. I think that's something that most of us who work online need to consider at some point, because I feel like I have a permanent divot in my couch from when I work at home of where I sit all the time, and I feel like I'm starting to build that in my seat at the office. I want to ask another totally unrelated question. We've been talking about cats before we started filming, which it reminds me a little bit of kind of like the importance of balancing real life and work life. What are the ways that you kind of keep yourself grounded outside of the amount of work? Because you've had a tremendous amount of success in your work life, whether or not you're like one of those people who's willing to admit it or not, but you've been incredibly successful. How do you balance all of that with your real life? And how big of a role does the cat play in that?
Well, I would say the cat plays a huge role in that. Well, family is really key. So, I'm married to someone who isn't an illustrator. So I think that really helps. If I get caught up with work and I try to tell her about it, she's like, this means nothing. This is ridiculous. Let's go watch some Friday Night Lights.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, all that stuff doesn't matter. And it's like, oh yeah, it's really not, you know, it's not life or death.
Yeah, it's nice to have that. Yeah. I think in some ways it's nice to be with somebody who understands what you do, and then sometimes it's nice to have somebody who looks at you like, none of this means anything outside of my work environment. And it's nice to have that sort of foil to people who do nothing but talk about illustration or the same things that you do every single day of your life.
And my cat is not an illustration fan necessarily.
Tell everybody your cat's name. What's a good cat name?
Fabrizio.
Yeah. I think that's one that really people should shoot for the stars with. That's a good, it's a very good cat name.
It's a good cat.
I want to ask about your Pie in the Sky project. I feel like you've had so many chances to do really cool things, but what's one thing you'd like to do that you haven't had a chance to do yet with your work?
Man, I feel like there's still a list. There's a lot of things that I still haven't done. I would, I'd love to do a New Yorker cover. And I've had a few of my sketches looked at, but nothing approved.
What's your dream New Yorker cover? Like, what would be the assignment or the theme they'd give you? Or do you want to just have, like, free reign?
I want free reign. Yeah. It would probably be, like, a seasonal type of thing. I don't know if I could do something that was based on current events, like a political thing. I don't know what I would be good at. But I want to do a music video.
Any band in particular?
There's a list of bands that I would like, but I don't want to mention them, and I'm going to wait and see.
You don't want to jinx it?
Yeah, I don't want to jinx it. So I'd like to do a music video. I don't know. There's a whole list. I mean, I feel like I'm just getting started.
Any hopes of still actually creating a band of your own?
Well,
of just illustrators from the pencil factory?
I've learned to never say never, but right now I think I'm content just drawing.
Yeah.
I play guitar now, and just for fun.
That's what. Yeah, I heard you have like a wall of guitars in your house. Do you have a wall? I heard you did.
No, just a couple.
I heard that. I heard that I was supposed to go check them out because they would be very cool.
I just have two.
Oh, that's a good start. That's
one's a
good
start. One's a ukulele, though.
Oh, that's a good way to start with the small portable ones. Yeah. Well, thanks so much for being here, Chris. Tell people where they can find you online.
You can find me at redsilas.com. You can find me at Twitter at @CSNeil. And I think you can find me on Tumblr, too. What is it? I think it's tumblr.csneil or however that works. csneil.tumblr.
That sounds right. Yeah, I think it's usually the Tumblr at the end. Yeah. Thanks so much for being here. And for all of you listening, definitely check out Chris's work. And we'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.